that's your station of smiles across the miles, spreading happiness all can share. Whether your transmission is HM or B, you're welcome to the world's largest happy family. So hello everyone, hello everywhere, from Alaska to Mexico. Come and join in the swing and have a merry fling with the Happy Station Family Show. Show calling listeners everywhere,
everywhere.
It's your station of smiles across the miles, spreading happiness all can share. Whether your transmission is HM or B, you're welcome to the world's largest happy family. So hello everyone, hello everywhere, from Alaska to
Mexico.
Come and join in the swing and have a merry fling with the Happy Station, Happy Station, Happy Station Family Show.
The Sunday Happy Station Show.
Hello everyone, hello everywhere. I'm Keith Perron and welcome again to another edition of the International Happy Station Show. And as you know, since the beginning of this year, that being 2010, we've been doing a number of special programs to kick off the new year, and today is definitely one of them. Now, before I tell you a little bit about that, I want to let you know about our website, which is www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com, and we currently have a poll going on our website. The question is, who is your favorite Happy Station host? The question is, who is your favorite Happy Station host? And you have five options. The first option is Eddie Starts, second, Tom Meyer, the third, Pete Myers, the fourth, Jonathan Gruber, and the fifth, yours truly. So we do have this poll. Do check us out at www.pcjmedia.com. Now, our special guest today is Kamal. Kamal, who was originally born in Malaysia, emigrated to Australia some 43 years ago. Well, he became an Australian citizen 43 years ago. He actually moved to Australia in the 1950s. In Australia, he is known as, you know, a legend in the world of music and many other things, and has made a number of television appearances. Now, many of our European listeners will know that name from a hit that he had in the 1970s called The Elephant Song. Now, our listeners in the U.S. may not be so familiar with him, but hopefully after today's show, you will be just as familiar with him as I am and our listeners in Australia and in Europe. Now, to kick off this interview, I was trying to think of what song we should begin with. Now, not too long ago, two listeners that we have in Albany, New York, Margaret and Tony, who've been married for 25 years in February, that's right, so happy 25th anniversary coming up in February, requested to hear the song called Take Good Care of Her. Now, as you know, we are not a request show, so we didn't really play it as a request, but it made me think for a moment, wait a minute, Kamal had recorded this song. So going out to Tony and Margaret for their upcoming 25th wedding anniversary to kick off today's special edition of Happy Station with Kamal, here he is with Take Good Care of Her on the International Happy Station.
suppose I ought to say congratulations, for you won the only girl I ever loved. But I hurt too much to face the situation. Just take good care of her. Take good care of her. Just to be around her was my greatest pleasure. She was everything my future held in store. So remember, when you take my only treasure, please take good care of her. Take good care of her. I must accept it. She loves you more than me. So with my broken heart, I'll bow out gracefully. Don't send me any wedding invitations, for I couldn't bear to see her there with you. If she's happy, that'll be my consolation. So take good care of her. Take good care of her. I must accept it. She loves you more than me. So with my broken heart, I'll bow out gracefully. Please don't send me any wedding invitation, for I couldn't bear to see her there with you. If she's happy, that'll be my consolation. So take good care of her. Take good care of her. Please take care of her. Take good care of her.
Joining us today on The Happy Station is Kamal, who is a legend in Australia, and as well as many of our European listeners will know that name from a song that we'll play later on in the show, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Joining us right now from his home in Australia is Kamal. Hello, Kamal.
Hello, Keith. This is indeed an unexpected pleasure and a privilege.
Well, this is an honor for me, because I remember your songs very well. My mother had a few of your albums, and the song that we're talking about, which concerns a very large animal, an elephant, I just gave it away, was a song that I remember very well. So this is a lot of fun for me. But before we get to the elephant song and everything else, you've said yourself that you are a 42-year-old Australian.
In other words, I've been an Australian citizen for 42 years, but I came to this country, to Australia, in 1953 from Malaysia, but not having any idea as to what my future was going to be. I think my parents, and especially my uncle who sponsored my scholarship here, I think they had dreams of me becoming either a doctor, lawyer, or an engineer. But somewhere along the way, they didn't realize that I wasn't a very good student. And in 1958, I came perilously close to being deported because I had sort of overstayed my visa. And by an unbelievable set of circumstances, I met a young man who said his name was Rupert Murdoch. And he came to my rescue and became my more or less guardian. And that was perhaps the only reason I managed to stay on. And in 1966, the Australian government changed their rules and they gave me a chance to become an Australian citizen. And hence, I took up that opportunity in 1967. That's why I said, I often say quite proudly that I'm a 42. Now I'm a 43-year-old Australian.
But let me ask you, during that period, was there any point that you thought that music could be a career? I mean, were you just singing in the shower?
I didn't dare sing in the shower because when I was going to school, or at least going to college, there were a lot of other students around. And I had this feeling that to sing was to be not quite macho. In other words, it's like boys who dance and the boys who sing, they are not altogether really masculine. That's a false perception in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a bit sensitive about that sort of thing. But yet, when I went to various parties, I envied anybody who could entertain. But I didn't know whether I could sing at all. And eventually, I decided that I would make an attempt to sing. And eventually, in 1958, I learned a Nat King Cole song called Nature Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And sang it at a party with the lights turned off because I was so nervous about facing people, especially strangers. And fortunately, on that occasion, the friends who were there responded warmly, and hence the genesis of a career that's lasted nearly a little over 50 years.
The first time that you sang in front of people at a party, I mean, was it at that moment that something inside of you kind of, was like a light bulb that went on and you said to yourself, maybe I could be doing this as a career since I'm a terrible student and I'm not going to study medicine. And then you started maybe looking at different options like performing in some local nightclubs to get some on-the-job training?
Far from it, because the first time I ever sang in front of a group of people would have been around 1955. And it was an experience that I enjoyed, even though I was extremely nervous. Or even these days, after all these years, still I get a little bit anxious till the first few minutes of the show. But it was not until 1959... when television started, I was invited to do the very first live television show. And one of the critics who saw the show said some very kind things about me. Maybe then there was an idea that there was some opportunity. But again, the man who really helped me to help me get into entertainment was, again, Rupert Murdoch, because he was the one who bought a television station.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1962, he left Adelaide with his family and came to Sydney. And in 1962, he invited me to come to Sydney and do some shows in a hotel here called the Australia Hotel. And that, perhaps, was a time when I felt there was a chance to make a career of it. And even then, I wasn't sure. But it was not until 1967, by an unbelievable set of coincidences, I got an invitation to record with Philips. And I remember recording a whole album in a space of 6 hours in a church just outside Sydney, the Hunter Bailey Church. And we did the whole album in about 6-7 hours, called A Voice to Remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there was a more firm idea of perhaps a career.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I waited another 2 years, of course, when again by an unbelievable set of circumstances and a lot of luck, there was a song that I heard called The Sounds of Goodbye, and that was the real beginning of my career.
I hear footsteps walking down the hallway in the middle of the night. Then I start hearing little sounds become so magnified here in the quiet. The kitchen phone that rings, and when you answer quickly, speaking in a whisper, I'm left to wonder why. I've got a lonely feeling that I'm hearing the sounds of goodbye. The sounds of goodbye. Your stocking feet that softly tiptoe through the room where I lay half asleep. The clinking hands, fumbling hands that close the closet door that always creaks. The snapping latches on the suitcase that you carried with you to your mother's on those weekends many times. I've got a lonely feeling that I'm hearing the sounds of goodbye. The sounds of goodbye. Of a pencil, writing words upon a note I'll hate to read. I call your name and hear a deafening silence, then the closing of a door. A roaring motor in the street, a stranger's cutting voice, then the violent rush of teardrops from my eyes. I've got a lonely feeling that I'm here. Sounds of goodbye. Sounds of goodbye.
When you did that first album for Philips, How did that happen? Did somebody from the A&R department at Philips just happen to see you and say, "Hey, look, we want to record you." I mean, or did you approach them to do a demo?
Okay, what happened was I was invited to sing at a ball where they announced the winner of the designer, the gown of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And my performance was immediately after the announcement. And you can imagine, with all the celebration of the winner, I don't think anybody paid any attention to me singing. And this was in 1966. And somehow, there was a lady who was working for an advertising company. To this day, I can't remember her name now. And she came to me and she said how much she enjoyed my singing and whether I had a recording of any kind. And I was quite taken back that somebody would ask that. So I finally I managed to go to a friend's place and did a very very amateurish recording and gave it to her. And I think her purpose was for me to do some commercials, but somehow the tape fell into the hands of whether she gave it or somebody else gave it, I don't know. It impressed a man called Arthur Major, who was then A&R director for Philips Records, and he was hell-bent in wanting to record me singing classical songs.
Mm-hmm.
And because that was his choice. But somehow I wasn't the least bit interested in singing classical music, even though I did know a few pieces. In fact, I even took part in an operatic competition in 1966 and did reasonably well. I didn't win it, but I was I was third in it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was more interested in reaching the general public through popular music, because my hero has always been, was and is, and will always be Nat King Cole. But when Arthur Major invited me to sing these things, I said no, so we compromised. And the first album was mostly show tunes. And it did better than I expected. I think we might have sold 2,000 or 3,000 copies.
Mm-hmm. But when you, at the time when you were recording for Philips, which was a major international label, did that bring you to the attention of music goers in Europe and in North America? I mean, was that album also distributed in Europe, or was it only Australia and New Zealand?
No, it made no impression anywhere, or even in Australia. But the first hit that I had was in 1969, The Sounds of Goodbye. That gave me a number one record in Australia. And it was not till 3 years later, in 1972, that I went to England, and I did a few shows with Sir Harry Secombe and Vera Lynn and people like that. And even then, I waited for a opening, and nothing really happened till 1975, after my performance at the London Palladium, that I got an invitation from Holland, from Piet Skelewis, mm-hmm. who was then president of Phonogram Records in Holland, for the world, for that matter. And he contacted me, because I had met him previously, and said that there was a song that they had in mind for me to record, and was called The Elephant Song. My immediate reaction was that I was an incurable romantic, that I only sang love songs. But he was able to convince me that this was a love of a different kind, a love of nature, that the elephant song was a metaphor, was for conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he sent me the music and the lyric. And if people understand that the words were Dutch English, meaning that it needed a little more poetry in it. So I had it revised by a man called Roger Waddis, who's no longer with us, but he was a poet and a satirist and a wonderful journalist, and who wrote it, rewrote it, within a matter of 3 hours between 9 p.m. and midnight,
mm-hmm.
the day before I came to Holland.
So you recorded that song in the Netherlands...
In the Netherlands, and the story goes, not the story goes, it's a fact that maybe it was exhaustion, maybe it was nerves, maybe it was a combination of everything. Having rehearsed the song, when they said action, or at least record, and the lights came on, I opened my mouth, and there was no sound. I had laryngitis, or whatever it was, I had no sound at all, and I was rushed to the ENT specialist, who looked down my throat, and the expression on his face led me to believe that was the end of my career, because I didn't think I was ever going to sing again.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a large, generous dose of cortisone injection. And I rested for about 3 hours and went back to the studio and started making some sound, and eventually I was able to record the song. And I remember thinking to myself then that this could be my swan song. The elephant song could be my swan song. But, and within 3 weeks of release, it was number one.
Tell me, said the elephant, tell me, brothers, if you can, why all the world is full of creatures, yet we go in fear of man. Tell me, said the elephant, tell me why this has to be. We have to run from man the hunter, never say. words and everything. We love to hear the children laughing when we're in the circus ring. Happy was the elephant, happy was his jungle life, and then they came.
Stay alive, then man and beast, we must work together, and together we will survive.
Listen, said the elephant, it is conservation time, so take the warning when we trumpet for the future of mankind.
During this period, because you spent, you know, like you said, some time in Europe just before you did the Elephant Song, how often would you go back to Australia to record? I mean, were you also going back to Australia to record an album and then flying back to Europe?
Yeah, I mean, all of my recordings till I came to England, weren't done in Australia, but my first overseas recording was in 1972 in England with Peter Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make much of an impression, even though I thought they were some of my better recordings of my career, because Peter Knight was just a wonderful, wonderful composer, not a composer, an arranger.
Mm-hmm.
And also the producer was Johnny Franz.
Right.
And recently there was a documentary about Dusty Springfield, because Johnny Franz produced several of Dusty Springfield's recordings. And nothing really happened overseas till the Elephant Song in the summer of 1975. And by the way, the Elephant Song was not only number one, it was number one for 6 consecutive weeks in Holland, and then, of course, Belgium, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the success was short-lived as far as Germany was concerned, because in Germany, there was a gentleman called Ozzy Drexler, and he wanted the Elephant Song sung in German. And they rewrote the lyrics, and it lost the whole appeal. It was called Wo die Freude wohnt, and it had, I had difficulty understanding it, and so did the German people, and nothing happened.
Even the title sounds frightening. But when you were in Europe recording, did you have a chance to record, for example, in German or French?
In fact, I sang about a half a dozen songs in German.
Mm-hmm.
But, there was a number of songs, but it didn't happen. Because I also recorded I did record in Hamburg,
mm-hmm.
and also in Denmark, in Copenhagen. But most of the European recordings were in either Holland or in England, London. mm-hmm. and a few in Los Angeles and New York.
Now, during this period, was there any attention from North America? I mean, did after the Elephant Song did well in Europe, did any labels in North America or Philips in North America say, look, we want to release this here, we want you to come over and do some television?
You're not going to believe this story. This is like, I mean, it will sound as though I'm making it up. What happened in late 1975 was we were dining, my wife and I was dining with a gentleman from Atlanta. His name was George Peek. And he was friendly with an Australian girl. She was Yugoslav, called Ivanka Lau. And whilst having dinner, I told them the story that I had hired the London Palladium, did my own show, and which was a success, which led to the Elephant Song and all of that. And they said, Winnie, what would you, you know, how about coming to America? So, and what would you like to do? And I said, oh, yeah, I'd like to sing at Carnegie Hall. Believe it or not, George Peek got up from the table, made a telephone call, and got me a booking at Carnegie Hall. You won't believe it. But anyway, unfortunately, it didn't have a very good ending to it, because I did come to Carnegie Hall and did my first show there in June of 1976. But George wouldn't let me do it my way. He did it his way. And it, even though I did actually record my performance at Carnegie Hall, the friendship ended very fast. And so I didn't go back to New York, to America, for the next 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And because of contractual problems. And then eventually, one of the members of the audience who were there at my performance in 1976, a lady called Judy Friedman, and her husband, Sid Friedman, who was then producer for NBC, made an offer to look after my interests in North America. And a career started there that brought me to Canada and America. Mm-hmm. And in Canada, believe it or not, I had a turntable hit. You know what a turntable hit is, where
yes.
they play the song, but you don't sell too many records, called Somebody Loves You. And a station in Toronto called CFRB played it and started a career for me there. And I went back to the Ontario place for 3 consecutive years to do some shows there.
Hmm. During this period, from what I gather is that even though you were overseas, Australia was still your main home. It's almost I sort of feel that you would pop over to Australia every few months. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, Australia was home, has always been home. And the European success made it possible for me to come there on a frequent basis. But the country where I also enjoyed our Australia's neighbor, New Zealand, and something extraordinary happened in 1978. What was the year when Saturday Night Fever, where Bee Gees had the Saturday Night Fever? That was 78?
Between 76 and 78, I believe.
Okay, now, by a set of, again, some unbelievable circumstances, the Bee Gees album Saturday Night Fever was number one everywhere in the world, except for 1 week in New Zealand. The Kamal album was number one. So I will always have a very soft spot for New Zealand.
When you're looking for songs, what is it that you look for?
For me, being an incurable romantic, it's always the lyrics first, mm-hmm. and then the melody. And I think it's a sort of an instinct. I don't know how else to explain it. When you hear it, when it reaches you, when it touches you, it is It's not an intellectual process. It's to do with an instinct, I think. I don't know how else to explain it. But almost every time, I mean, for example, when I first heard And I Love You So by Don McLean, long before Perry Como even heard of it, I fell in love with it, and I did record it in England, but unfortunately it was not a very good recording. The performance, and we didn't have the magic solution for it. But the song, to this day, I think it is, it's not the definitive love song, but close to it.
Mm-hmm. Does it happen that you find a song and you think at first, well, okay, you know what, I really like this, I love the lyric, but then after you do it, you say to yourself, you know what, something is missing, but I can't put my finger on it.
Usually it's to do with the lyric. I mean, in fact, there was a song that I recorded in 1978 called What Would I Do Without My Music, which is more or less... are you familiar with Schubert's An die Musik?
Yes.
Yeah. It is, the pop version of An die Musik called What Would I Do Without My Music. And when I first heard it, there was the original lyric, it didn't gel with me. There was a line called, Why Are People's Eyes So Blind? And I took it upon myself without contacting the writer. And I put a line in, why are people so unkind? And would you believe for the last 30 years or so, that line, why are people so unkind, has been tagged to me.
Mm-hmm.
And these sort of things happen, either a lyric or a part of the melody. If it doesn't gel, I take the liberty of adjusting it, but I never ask for any royalty for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to explain it. It's just a feeling. It doesn't mean I'm right, but that's the way it is.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to a special edition of the International Happy Station Show with my very special guest, Kamal. Do check us out online at www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. You can send us an email through the website or at the following email address, pcj.happystation@gmail.com. That's pcj.happystation@gmail.com. Let's now take a listen to a very well-known song that was composed by French singer and songwriter Charles Aznavour. It's called You've Got to Learn. Here's Kamal on the Happy Station.
You've got to learn to show a happy face, although you're full of misery. You mustn't show a trace of sadness and never look for sympathy. You've got to learn, although it's very hard, the way you're pocketing your pride. And sometimes face humiliation while you're burning up inside. Facing reality is often hard to do when it seems happiness is gone. You've got to learn to hide your tears and tell your heart life must go on. You've got to learn to leave the table when love's no longer being served. Just show them all that you are able to leave without saying a word. You've got to learn to hide your sorrow and go on living as before. What good is thinking of tomorrow? Who knows what you may have in store? You've got to learn to be much stronger. At times your head should rule your heart. You've got to learn from hard experience and listen to lies and sometimes pay the price. But you must learn to live with a broken heart.
There must be a certain amount of pride to think that, you know, you immigrated to Australia and became an Australian citizen. And all of this happened. It's almost like a dream.
In fact, in 1995, after I was given the Order of Australia, which is an honor bestowed by the Queen, Queen of England, there was a story of my life, my biography, authorized biography, and it was called An Impossible Dream, but because that's what it has been. Especially, you know, looking back over my life in those very, very difficult times, for an Asian person to have been accepted the way I have been is nothing really short of an impossible dream.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way that I feel little satisfied that I've been able to coin a phrase, to build a step for those who follow, they can climb a little higher. And I think, you know, I've been of some use to my fellow Asians.
Mm-hmm. And from your family in Australia, when you said, hey, look, I just had my first hit here in Australia, back to your family in Malaysia, what was their reaction?
What I didn't tell you was that when I met my wife and we were married, I was so concerned about my parents' reaction, I didn't tell them about my marital status for 2 years. And they found out about it in a magazine because I had appeared in a movie and there was a story about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they were absolutely horrified that I was got into show business. But once, of course, our children were born and I had a hit record, you would have thought that they were responsible for all of it. But then I did eventually go back to Malaysia in 1982 because I was so nervous about facing my Asian audience, because I've never sung before an Asian audience in all my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was self-conscious. I thought they might think that was a turncoat, that I was singing white man's music instead of my own indigenous music, you know, which was Indian music. And I was always guilty of that sort of feeling. So I went and did a show in Hong Kong in 1982 before going to Malaysia. And fortunately, it was a success.
When you went back to Malaysia, did you even consider recording some, say, songs from Malaysia? I mean, there's a singer in the Netherlands by the name of Anika Granlo. She's originally from Indonesia.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, she recorded a collection of songs which are popular Indonesian songs, but they did a different arrangement to them and everything, and it was a big success.
Yeah. I did a couple of songs in Malay for the performances there, but it was never not as a recording, but a performance, and I sang it in Malay.
Mm-hmm.
But never ever felt confident enough to actually make a recording of it. But the career sort of waxed and waned. I mean, I went back there to do a few shows. But then nothing happened for about a few years. And then I went back there a couple of years ago and for fundraisers, and it was extremely successful.
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful irony about going back to Malaysia, as you can imagine, it was under British occupation for many years. And as a young boy, I always envied always enjoyed cricket being played at the Selangor Club, which was the club where only the Europeans were allowed membership. And we, as non-whites, I don't think we were even allowed to go in there. And would you believe, in 1982, I gave a performance there, and they paid to come and see me there, including the king of Selangor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a strange irony.
Hmm.
And also, I had a lot of my school friends that I was trying to impress. And unfortunately, it was a successful evening.
It amazes me because from what I gather, you have no signs of slowing down. You're busy today. The question that I'm leading to is: do you still get as much thrill performing today as you did when you were first starting out?
I think in a way more so, you know, only because maybe I'm a bit lit more relaxed. And also in the knowledge that it's not going to last forever, and each performance becomes even more precious than the last. And fortunately, the reaction has been fantastic. But at the same time, I'm aware that some of my contemporaries are not enjoying good health, let alone able to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much aware of how lucky I've been to have reasonable health, because there were a couple of scares. In 1979, I had Bell's palsy, if you know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Bell's palsy, that was could have ended my career in a way if it had gone wrong. And then about 6 years ago, I had a total thyroidectomy, which is an operation that could have rendered me voiceless. But fortunately, again, I had such a wonderful surgeon who removed my thyroid and gave me back my voice. So in many ways, I've been lucky to enjoy a reasonable health.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, unlike a pianist, you know, if you lose your voice, there's nothing left, really.
And that was Kamau, my special guest on this edition of The International Happy Station. You can check out his website at www.kamau.com. And I'll spell that for you. That's www, dot, you know, the little period thing, kamahl.com. Once again, www.kamahl.com. Now, before we end off, there's a few things that I want to mention. First, our Facebook page. If you want to join the Happy Station Facebook page, it's very easy to do. If you're already a member, just do a search for PCJ Media or The Happy Station Show. Click on Join the Group, and that's all you need to do. So just do a search in Facebook for PCJ Media or The Happy Station, and then join the group. Now, our own website for the show, which has a lot of information. For example, all the details that you need to know to listen to The Happy Station Show wherever you are in your part of the world, just go to www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. We made some changes recently, and somebody wrote in not too long ago asking me, well, where do I click? Do I click on schedule or partner stations? Well, you can click on one of the two depending on where you are. Now, some of our partner stations would be like KBCT in Waco, Texas, South Hearts Radio in the UK, and some others. And for our regular schedule, you can just click on broadcast schedule, where you have the times, frequencies, all in UTC, by the way. That's Universal Time Coordinate. And you can listen to us that way. The other way, of course, is some of the stations that we have listed, either in our partner station schedule or on our schedule part of the webpage, also have web links. Now, the web links also have the online streaming. So if you are outside of the target area, you can click onto the web streaming for that station and listen to us that way. It's very, very easy. And of course, if you missed it for whatever reason, and you want to hear this edition of the show, which you missed, which you're probably listening to, which doesn't make any sense what I just said, or you want to listen to maybe some past shows that you did miss, just click on the archive section of our website, and that will be forwarded to another website, which will have all the past editions of the show. We have a new poll going now on our website, which is, who is your favorite Happy Station host? Yes, the question is, who is your favorite Happy Station host? You have five choices. The choices are, number one, Eddie Starts. Number two, Tom Meyer. Number three, Pete Myers. Number four, Jonathan Gruber. And number five, yours truly. So do take part of the poll. We'll be announcing the winners later on. I, of course, don't expect to win. I have already voted, and believe it or not, it wasn't even for myself. And it was a difficult choice because I voted twice for two people. So do check us out, www.pcjmedia.com, and you'll find that in the front page. If you want to write us, our email address is pcj.happystation@gmail.com. That's pcj.happystation@gmail.com. You can also write us the old-fashioned way via snail mail. Our postal address is Happy Station Show, PCJ Media, which is very easy. And here is the postal address, which I will say slowly. 8th floor, that's 8th floor, number 47, that's number 47, Lane, L-A-N-E 31, Lane 31, Section 1, S-E-C-T-I-O-N, Section 1, Sanmin Road, that's S-A-N like Norman, M like Mother, A-N Road, Sanmin Road, Banqiao, B-A-N-C-I-A-O, Taipei, Taiwan, and the postal code is 22070. But you can find the information, by the way, at our website. Anyway, that's it. That's all we have time for. So on behalf of our technician, Kevin Lee, our production assistant, Johan Backer, this is Keith Perron all the way in Taipei, Taiwan, wishing you well and hoping to see you again next week for another edition of the International Happy Station. So until next time, friends, so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios, amigos, and sayonara.